But the Democratic Party passed its supreme test in its role as the party that approaches and takes in any opposing motion against the ruling class, and is able to, therefore, kill it. It was proven when the small farmers, as industrial capitalism developed in this country, began to naturally be driven down. They were historically gone. You could not force capitalism back into small businesses. Monopolies were developing. That's progress. The thing to do, of course, is take over the monopolies. They wanted to cut them up again. Can't go back in history. But nevertheless, the populist movement was an outburst of the small farmer against the development of monopoly capitalism. And in their own confused way, because they were themselves property owners, and therefore their program could not offer a real alternative to capitalism itself, they began to try to find some means to struggle back. They filled Farmers Alliance and so forth. They eventually ended up taking on a political form, beginning to challenge the ruling class politically. Now, I don't want to go over it. It begins around 1880. You know, for 10 years, they had more rainfall in the West, the beginning of the end of the prairies, than is normal. And a massive American people became convinced that this was a real great place to go, and they all went. And then it stopped raining in 1886, and panic ensued. They started going back. And then the freeze came in, too, and killed all the cattle in that area. There was a real depression, a conjuncture of many factors that happened and created a real deep radicalization in the Midwest and in the West around the end of the 1880s. But the same process was taking place in the South. And what happened is you ended up with a populist movement. To make a long story short, it had within it, it was a classical populist, Narodnik-type movement, small farmers, but it had within the embryos of all the working class formations. It had the rural proletariat as represented by the Negro farm worker within it, organized independently in its own populist organizations. It had the nucleus of the industrial proletariat in the South in it, and it had a semi-alliance with the developing working class organizations in the Northeast cities. And it had two ways it could go. It could either seek to win and influence a section of the ruling class to solve its problems, or it could turn to the working class and the program it can offer, that is a socialist alternative, to solve their problem. Now, for one thing, the labor movement was not strong enough, just hadn't developed in this country to present much of an alternative at that time. And just like under Reconstruction, the capitalist class historically wasn't interested in their problems. Just as the whole class was interested in smashing Reconstruction, they were interested in, as far as the populace, was to remove the problem and proceed as fast as possible with industrialization. The question is how to do it. Here's millions of people waking up, holding their meetings out in the countryside, singing songs, beginning to think politically. Radical speakers getting up and raising all types of ideas. Most of them, 90% of them, were kooky ideas and nuts, okay, because they were trying to think of some way to get around these problems without leaving the framework of capitalism. But nevertheless, people were in motion and they didn't have control over it. In fact, they got into such motion they began to win elections. In the South, where the battle was extremely important, because if the populace would win, they were going to reintroduce civil liberties for the black people. And that became a very important danger for the ruling class, that the rural proletariat would now be freed from the control they had over it by the semi-dictatorship type of governments they had in the South, where black people had no vote. And this alliance began to develop. And in the South, when they won elections, as they did, the Democrats just said, no, you didn't win. Now, when that happens, you've got a choice, one of two things. You know, take a vacation or get up some arms and say, we won and we're the government, and it's tough macaroni. You lost. Now, the composition of the populace being what it is, it wouldn't fight that way, and it couldn't. It was a composition of a multi-class mix-up. There were some big landowners in the populace. Of course, they didn't want to fight. And all from the very beginning, there was this confusion of classes within it. But there was the potential that a section of it could be won to a socialist movement, that when the inevitable split between the different layers within the populace came, that a section could be won to the working class and would be independent in terms of both its program and its organization. Capitalist class wanted to stop this. Now, the Democrats in the South were their main enemy. The Democratic Party was the main opponent, the one they had the hardest battles, the ones they met in the fields with guns and actually shot it out At one point, a Negro was going to speak, and the Democrats were going to shoot him in Augusta, Georgia, and 2,000 poor whites armed themselves, rode into the town, and took it over to defend the right of a Negro to speak. That was the type of mood that the populace had in 1892. But the government had to smash it. What did they do? The Democrats began to rethink. They began to say, well, we're not so opposed. Farmers? Why, you want some silver? We'll give you silver. They began to adapt this and that to their program, which was unessential. And the key to it wasn't whether they adapted or didn't adapt. What they wanted to do was destroy their independent formation of the smash. And the whole historic period in this whole rise came, like sometimes history does, moves it into a few hours when all the forces come to play and the decisions are made. In a convention which you could spend hours just reading about, and you can see all the class forces in motion, all the development of American history at that point in the class struggle, the convention that took place in 1896, July 22nd, when the populace met and presented before them was the proposal that they dissolve and join the Democrats. And the two forces were conflicting. The embryonic development of a socialist movement in the United States and of the working class was there too. E.B. Debs had just become a Marxist. Whole future of what would happen within the populace was praised. And let me just tell you what happened at that convention. It was 1,400 delegates. The poorest wing, especially from Texas, were the militants. They had no shoes on, for instance, at the convention. You could tell the different classes within the convention, but just what they, the way they appeared. And they came there determined to stay independent of the two parties, to stay independent of the ruling class, as they saw it, which in the terms they understood it from their class point of view. Democrats controlled the apparatus. They controlled the conference hall. First thing they did was the left wing prepared this big demonstration. They were going to, you know, traditional American convention, they were going to parade with flags and wave banners and yell and scream to show their strength. And you see, pick fights with anybody, of course, you disagree with them to show their strength. So as soon as they got into the convention hall, Democrats turned off the lights. They were out in pitch dark. Couldn't hold their demonstration. Now, right then and there, you see, a working class organization probably would have left the hall and gone somewhere else and hold their meeting or beat up the guys who were in charge of the light. But precisely the type of wavering that this type of layer in the American public, they wavered, they didn't know what to do. They tried to hold the demonstration, they gave it up. They came in the second day, try again. Second day, they won again. They passed a motion which was in their favor. But in all this, they had no concise program, no leadership, no alternative. The only section that could have provided it, that could have ended the dismiss, was the working class. And this left-wingers, especially the Texas delegation, said, let's nominate Debs for president. Here was a working class, representing the working class, a guy who just turned socialist, and they raised the concept, let's nominate Debs. You know what Debs did? He sent a telegram to the convention saying, I want you to support the Democratic Party. I want you to support Bryan, and my name cannot be considered. And in that short stroke, you have within it capsulized the fact that the American working class had not yet developed a conscious wing, conscious expression of its own class interest. And having that missing, there was nowhere this populist movement could go. But interesting in its history and the development of how the Democratic Party approached it, we can see that their role as demagogues was became essential. Now, when Bryan gets nominated by this convention, I don't want to go into all the details, there's a lot more gory in it. When you get down to it, the way they outmaneuvered him was just fantastic. When he gets nominated, now the Republican candidates can blast Bryan as a left-wing communist, anything they want. There's no danger now from the left. The thing's been, now they can present him as a real menace, you see, in their propaganda and hope that they can get, play on all the weaknesses and the backwardness of the masses that still exist to win, even having the most reactionary get in. Because if Bryan should get in, he's a reactionary too. There's no problem. He's part of the ruling class. His vice presidential candidate was a banker from Maine. Will oppose every single plank of the populist program. So they had, either way, they win. So they might as well play it for all it's worth and have their right-wing guy go as right-wing as he wants. They can't lose. See? And that opened up the invasion of Cuba. It opened up, by the defeat of the populists, the possibility then to really smash the Negroes in the South. And that's when all the laws were passed in the South, taking away the right of Negroes to vote formally. All the grandfather clauses, the poll taxes, and all these things were passed after, except in Mississippi, after Reconstruction was defeated. And then that's when Roosevelt went down there and made his tour of the South, speaking about how not allowing Negroes to vote was not in violation of the 15th Amendment, and where the hardest period for the Negro people fell right after that. So in both the Reconstruction and in the populist movement, we see this party, the Democratic Party, developing as the party that tries, that has place for the support of mass layers of the people precisely to cut off and to destroy developments which they might break. 1896 was the last major challenge in terms of electoral politics that any section outside of the direct control of the ruling class ever had in terms of electoral politics. Their next challenge, social movement, comes in the CIO. And then all their experience in the ruling class on how to handle this, born out of Reconstruction of the populace, comes into play. And we'll discuss that next time. And then in this context, let's look at the new rising Negro movement that began with the Second World War and has been rapidly increasing its pace, and with the now embryonic development of the anti-war movement, and to what we can expect the tactics of the ruling class will be. And in all this, throughout this whole process, it wasn't any malicious intent of any individual that they, in the populace, to get into the Democratic Party, and as we will learn in the CIO, it was simply in every case that the ruling class had no section whatsoever which was in its interest to accomplish the problems that these people had, and therefore to seek an alliance or try to work within them or with them could only end in defeat, because historically there was just nothing in the interest of the class you were appealing to, the class you were trying to seek support from, which was in their interest. So the first thing you've got to ask yourself, whether you want to set up a coalition with any class, and most certainly the class that rules over you, is it in its interest? Is it going? Because if it isn't, it's not going to support you. As after the populace and Reconstruction, anyone who studies American history can see it. The last progressive stand of the industrial capitalist class in this country, finance capitalism, was when they opposed slaveocracy. Since then, they have had no interest, it has not been in their interest, to have any forward social step of any sort. Anything they've given has been under pressure, only to stem other problems. And they have developed in the United States what we call the two-party system. Very important for them. Any formation like that, and this whole myth about the two-party system doesn't come out of the blue, it came out of the history of the actual class struggle. After the defeat of the populace, this became a big thing in American literature, about the two parties, how they can contain everything, how all problems can be resolved within this context, how it's wrong to think in any other context. And also, by the way, with the death of the populist movement, the socialist movement begins its first organizational programmatic developments in any sort of large scale, and by the way, wins to it large layers of the militants and the populace, especially in areas like Texas. And also the IWW develops and finds in its base also a lot of these ex-populists and the ones who were lost their land and became rural landless workers. And then as we have the discussions here on the history of the American radical movement, you can see how this gradually becomes much, the development of a working class movement becomes more proletarian and less based from the rural workers or the small farmers. The class program becomes clearer and clearer until you get the founding of the first Marxist Party in 1928. Okay, so that's about it. Then next time we will go into the CIO and the question of the Labor Party then, and then the present situation. No, well, okay,
The question is, does he really consider a first Marxist party? Does he consider that CP is so uneducated?
Yeah, all right. Okay, why don't people who are going to leave, and those who want to stay for questions, stay, because we can't do it. Okay, the question is, I made a little passing remark at the end about the first Marxist party being formed in 1928. Let me take that back so we don't have to discuss it, and I'll leave the question open so other people can explain it. It raises a very deep question which can't be discussed. I mean, what depends on exactly what way you want to use the word Marxist. In a certain sense, it most certainly can be said that the first Marxist Party in the United States was 1928, in my opinion. Of course, this is not. But, and in many other ways, it can be said the Communist Party most certainly was the first Marxist Party in the United States. Okay, is there any questions or anybody want to disagree? Anybody want to challenge? Sure. Most of them were Southerners by birth and by being brought up. Some of them weren't. The first governor of Florida was known as Millionaire Drew, who was from New Hampshire and was a Northerner from New Hampshire, naturally. And he was a labor tycoon. The first Reconstructionist governor in Virginia was a Republican carpetbagger, banker. So in some cases, they were Northerners. But what all the Northern companies did is they immediately hired Southern, especially anybody who'd been a Southern Confederate general. I mean, there were all types of colonels, and you know, because they had a lot of colonels and generals and stuff like that. And they were all over the place, and every big company was, you know, they were out making a living by, you know, begging or anything, because these guys were so unused to work, they couldn't work. But the companies went out and found them, and they gave them jobs as representatives to the public. So whenever a Northern company wanted to make a statement in the South, they would have one of these colonels come walking out with all this Confederate uniform and the medals and say, well, we Southerners, you know, down here want to do this and that. So, give you an example, in Alabama, when Reconstruction started, Louisiana, they set up a lottery, and they were raking the money in with this lottery. It was a carpetbagger, capitalist from the North, came down, set up a lottery, and all lotteries are usually to milk the working class, work poor people. So they were doing real good business. And then these guys were not, you know, too concerned about just whether it was Reconstruction or not, but as Reconstruction ended and Redemption set in, they still wanted the lottery. So they immediately went out and hired the biggest Southern generals they could to be the guys who picked the thing and announced them. See? So they could now be a Southern company. And that lottery company controlled Louisiana for about 20 years in that period. I mean, had complete control. When the legislature would pass a motion against them, because some Democrats got all excited about returning back to the South type thing, and voted against the lottery. You know what the lottery had? they ruled the whole, they just moved in and had their judges and their lawyers and all their politicians move in and just cancel the whole legislature, hold new elections, put in their people, and settle the question by writing into a new constitution, which they had written for the state of Louisiana. They wrote in the lottery as part of the constitution so that they could be assured of their rule. So you see, they were Northern companies, but they were always looking for Southern spokesmen. And therefore, a lot of these governors were lawyers, for instance, who were Southern attorneys for the Northern Railroad Company. By the way, the Louisville and Nashville that had control of most of this was the capital, and it was about 50-50 between the United States and England. And that didn't change until after a crisis a little later. I think it was 1877 it began to change, and the United States had control of these stocks. But no, they were Southerners as a whole, but working for Americans. Some of them were, some of them weren't. Some of them became... were they Democrats? Some of them became Democrats who had been Republicans. Some of them had a history of being Democrats even prior. Most certainly all these Confederate generals, you know, had been slave owners and had been Democrats. But take the guy who became the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta, which was the head... the key city for the South financially, was the one of the Reconstruction governors, a Republican who now becomes a Democrat. The guy who wrote the anti-Negro legislation for Mississippi, which broke with the Mississippi plan to break the right of Negroes, was written by a governor under Reconstruction, a Republican. So you have within it the general Republican capitalists switch over and become Democrats in the South, and the Republican Party disappears. Becomes almost an all-black party. In fact, to show their fear, their class fear, they met in a convention in Mississippi at one point, and the Negroes demanded that they wanted proportional representation on elected bodies. The number of votes they put up, the number of seats, that would have given them 95%. And they had 5%. And oh man, that time they switched over to the Democratic Party faster than hell. Because then you would have had a labor government. And they would have had land reform. Yes? Right. Yes, let me point. Yeah, the question is, was there before the Civil War any Southern industrial capitalist class, and basically what role did they play? Is that what your question is, right? Yeah, in doing this, giving any talk of this nature, you can't go into all aspects. But this is a very important aspect in this sense. that, remember when I spoke about the Whig, this coalition, and then it breaks, and they form the Democratic Party, becomes a coalition led by, well, some naturally didn't want to. And some of the ones that didn't want to break this coalition were the small beginning industrial capitalists of the South. They remained Whigs. And they also tended to agree to develop some sort of formulation to abolish slavery gradually, like, you know, 1% a year for 100 years. No, these proposals were actually made. There were proposals that, like, anybody born after a certain year then would be free, and then, you know, so much. And so they had all different types of ways to gradually. And when the Civil War came, most of them just shut up, sat back, and hoped to hang on to their money. Some actually went over to the North, very few. A lot of them went over to the South. As soon as the war was over, of course, they found themselves in the Republican Party as being small capitalists. Many of them became leaders of the Democratic Party. And out because they had the same political line the Democratic Party then developed and had been traditionally speaking for it and had standing within the ruling class as such. Van Woodward has done a fabulous job of documenting the discussions by looking up the personal letters between these people, Northern capitalists, as they discussed this whole question, and as the Southern Whigs said to the Northern capitalists, you might as well dump Reconstruction now. The situation's completely in hand. If you allow the Democratic Party to smash the Negro, everything will be fine here. We will support all your national legislation. We guarantee you that. And in our history books, when 1877 comes, remember the Compromise of 1877? Everybody reads about it. Everybody learns it right in school. The Compromise in 1877, you pull out the Northern troops in return for Hayes becoming president, even though he wasn't elected president, and that there was a big crisis and so forth. A lot of garbage. It wasn't returning the South to Southern rule. What simply had happened is the Northern capitalists had destroyed Reconstruction, and now we're establishing their rule on a national scale. And there was no crisis. The papers, some of the Democrats, let me just give you a sense. Democrats in Congress were up in arms making speeches about never will we let Hayes have it, and so forth and so on and so on. Then they held a caucus, and one of the big, you know, guys in with the railroads and the capitalists says, no, you guys got the wrong line. We don't need to have that this year. We're going to vote and put Hayes in. It's all settled. We've worked out. We've ironed out the whole thing. And the whole thing that we're ironing out had nothing to do with Reconstruction, with troops, with nothing. What it had to do with was which way the railroads were going to go and who was going to own what sections of the railroads. And once that thing had been settled and compromises had been achieved, they went in the next day. Democrats voted solidly, wham, to put Hayes in. Not directly a Hayes. The questions were all secondary, like who was going to be the third man of the commission that's going to decide which way. So that the Whigs and all this whole, you know, conflict that's called the 1877 conflict, it's just baloney, that's all. They have their, you know, the version they want American people to learn, and it's just not correct. Yeah?
Yeah, another one, too. I'm not to the point with American history, but I am curious, was there any sort of indemnity that the South had to pay after the war? And was it also part of that? How did the bourgeoisie of the North establish its control? For example, what happened to these plantations? Were they bought out by minorities and friends?
Okay, let me start the repeat it all over again. Say it again. Summarize it. The indemnity first, and then you went, okay. The question was, did the South have to pay any indemnity? And secondly, what happened to the big plantations? Is that a good way to summarize? Okay. Well, okay, let me do the plantation thing first. Many, many things happened. Some plantations survived, this big plantations owned by Southerners. A very large turnover did take place in the ownership of the land, primarily to a certain amount of it becoming actually smaller, but a large amount is indirect ownership. You say, where people were renting out or small farmers got into debt to banks, and the whole relationship of the land became much more and became definitively connected with Northern interests, the railroads and so forth. There was a lot of still landowners left, many of them Northerners, who came down right after the Civil War and bought land. Now, on the indemnity, you may not believe this, but what almost happened after the Civil War wasn't that the Southerners had to pay, but the North almost had to pay the South. At least that's what the Southerners wanted. And they went to Congress with making motions and stuff to get money for all their slaves. To my knowledge, and I believe this is correct, and it's so unbelievable that even though I read it and I keep remembering, I still keep thinking I must be wrong. Not a single rebel. Now, you know, today they talk a lot about insurrections, about armed conspiracies to overthrow the government by force and violence. Well, you know, the Southerners tried it. You know, the Southern ruling class didn't talk about it. They did it. Not one person was shot. And I believe that no one served more than a few years imprisonment. And I may be wrong about this. Just not sure, but that's what I remember. In any case, some of the plantation, take Jefferson Davis's big plantation. The minute the Civil War was over, the Negroes on his plantation took it over, started running for themselves. In fact, they drew a line. So no white people could come on the plantation. It was strictly for them. And that whole thing was turned back over to Davis, the federal government. There was only one case that I know of where any sort of indemnity was paid. And that was in Alabama when the Negroes went to the Reconstruction Convention to write the Constitution. A Negro from Dallas County, that's where Selma, Alabama is, right next to Lowndes County, got up and made a motion that slaves be paid for back pay owed them. And of course, this was, you know, a tremendous motion. And slave owners went wild, you know, I mean, whatever, capitalists were still around. And they finally made their legal point that at least since the Emancipation Proclamation, which was 5 years back, 4 years back, and they won at the rate of $10 a month back pay to 1863, and it passed 50 to 30. And today, Negroes still can't get, has trouble getting the right to vote in Selma, Alabama. So that, you know, I don't have to tell you. Okay, any other questions? But as a whole, you see, the ruling class didn't want to, you know, this was, why suppress them? You want to set the norm that ruling classes get suppressed, you know? They tried very rapidly to get them back in.
I have a personal suggestion that you hold the facts to the mass on your own basis, and you are able to be more accurate than you do, that you,
I prepared a bibliography for the YSA and sent it to them, and they told me they were going to publish it, but I guess they haven't had a chance, or they haven't found a form to do it in. If people want to read more about this, what I would suggest is you read the, you see, unfortunately, there is no single book that's any good on these periods. Stamp is the best, but you see, you got to understand this stuff. You have to read so much because you got to begin figuring it out for yourself. None of them, of course, have a class line. They're all covering different things. Now, some of the early revisionist writings are good because they dug into the facts and they weren't writing at the time that the civil rights struggle was going on. A lot of the ones who write now are covering their flanks, being careful not to give in, for instance, any information that would help the nationalists. And they write, you know, they're very cautious because I see changes happen in the last few years among some of the liberals like C. Van Woodworth and Kenneth Stamp in the way they write about Reconstruction. But, okay, if you want to read Du Bois' classic. It's not a history book, but it gives you a good feeling for what happened. Anything written by the CP is worthless. It's just totally factually incorrect. Facts are taken that have absolutely no importance and flown up as though they're the most important thing that happened. And their whole approach to the whole development and Reconstruction was there were good guys who went down there to try to make democracy, especially these abolitionists, middle class guys who went down and got together with Negroes and they're all fighting for democracy, and then there was the real bad Bourbons. And they had a big fight. And look how lousy America is that the Northern government didn't do anything about this and allowed the Bourbons to come back to power. Now, by the way, the nice middle-class abolitionists, you know what happened to them? As a whole, they became anti-Negro in the 1880s. You know Stowe, the one who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin? She wrote in the Herald Tribune in the 1880s that the Negroes had everything they needed in the South. A lot of them sold out when reaction came in. Very few really held out. They show their class base. I don't know. Well, Garrison, yeah. Well, the pacifist wing tended to quit. They sent it to a fort just for the revolution. I mean, just for the abolition. Now, anything by Kenneth Stamp or C. Van Woodward is very good. The Origins of the New South, the first chapter, gives you the statistics as to who became the new redemption government. That's The Origins of the New South. We sell it in all our bookstores by C. Van Woodward. And there's a book by a guy by the name of Wharton written in 1947 called The Negro in Mississippi, which is the best for documentation of how the Democratic Party dissolved and the new one was built and the splits within the Republican Party. His book isn't about that. He just says that in passing. But for him, it wasn't historically important. And then there's some little books of guys writing a PhD who are just writing to make a living or to get a degree or something, which are written, you know, in the most boring manner possible, but which have good facts that sneak through, like the Negro Militias, that little book by Otis, whatever his name is, which we sell that too, and it's Merit Publisher sells it, called Negro Militias. That gives you documentation how the Ku Klux Klan and the rest were just armed bodies of the Democratic Party. Why wasn't John Brown successful? Why didn't the uprisings of the slaves take place? Now, okay, there's two separate questions. Let's go over John Brown first. John Brown's idea wasn't bad at all. It's not that John Brown had a nutty idea and just made a desperate move. It was a little adventuristic, you know, from looking at it, but his idea was basically sound. That was to create a guerrilla-based movement through the Appalachians, which would continuously harass the slavocracy and try to develop a gradual build-up until they could have an insurrection against the slavocracy and overthrow it. If the end of slavery had come that way, it would have been much better. It would have had much deeper social impact. You see, if you study the Haitian Rebellion, the only slave rebellion that succeeded in ending slavery without any other class interfering in the battle, you realize why it was so difficult in the United States for a rebellion to take place. You gotta remember that the black slave is outnumbered, even within the South, by people who are benefiting indirectly or think they're at least of benefiting. There's other class layers which outnumber them. On top of that, they're spread out. And any uprising tends to take spontaneous form in an immediate area. All the attempts to link up information and to build on a broader basis were easily cracked in the early periods, and therefore uprising after uprising failed. If the crisis had deepened, and more the alliance of the middle small farmer in the West had not been through the industrial bourgeoisie, but in direct contact, like within the South itself, and some sort of actions, as did take place in some areas where whites joined with black slaves in rebelling, then you might have had a successful one. It's impossible to say if slavery had continued just at which way it would have ended. It was historically doomed. It had to expand, and it had to expand hard and fast. It would have to have taken up all the Caribbean and almost all the United States to the West if it were to continue to live. But basically what made it impossible for the Negro people alone to rebel or successfully or to withstand Reconstruction was the diversity and the fact that it was all agriculture. It was not, you know, it wasn't like a proletarian revolution. So look at the history of all slave societies back. Their ideal was some sort of commune, some sort of communal setup. But yet, as Marx, you know, explained in the history of the past, that this were impossible until capitalism came along and created the productivity. In a sense, this was part of it. The fact that the working class is the only class that could solve fundamentally problems didn't exist in any size, any significant size. Okay. Question is, why, let me try to summarize it. Why was there this conflict between the slaveocracy and the industrial capitalist? Why couldn't they really work out their interests together? The second is, why did it permeate? I'm sorry, what was the second part? Southerners were not.
Okay. Well, let me first begin with the question of the conflicts. At first they fought, saying the Constitution was a compromise. And they passed a rule that in 1808, no more slaves would be imported. That's in the Constitution, I believe, and that rule was withdrawn. What happened was it became more profitable. Cotton began to rise, and the slaveocracy just, you know, went back on their conception that the nation was going to move in the direction of industrial capitalism, and they tried to, and they began to develop hegemony within the class. I mean, yeah, within the class. Now, what happens is it could become a direct conflict. One can't go without the other. Let me show you how it came into conflict. So one thing you can see it in the apparel. Cotton's just so high, you see. It's got to sell it to England. Now, the Northerners are interested in putting up some big tariffs on anything that England imports comes into the country so that locally you have to buy goods from the North. Now, those industrial goods sometimes, and in most cases, were selling at more expensive than could be bought from England. The cotton grower, he's got to buy mechanical goods, he's got to buy industrial goods, he wants to buy them from the free market where he at the prices of the free market. He's got to sell his cotton in the free market. He's got no control over that because he's got to sell it to outsiders. The Londoner is interested in selling the cotton manufacturer his industrial goods. And he wants the cotton industry to buy it from him, not from England. So right away they start fighting over what the tariffs would be. Not only that, the tremendously developing market among the small farmers in the West becomes very important to the development of industrial capitalism in the East. And they want to open up these lands for you small farmers to some extent, and they also want to open up all these lands for their warlords and so forth. They want to tax for these things. And they start running themselves into a continuous hassle. You see over it. Also, the southern bureaucracy in having to demand to expand itself, you see, is therefore assuring itself of hegemony. Because the world is going to expand, it's going to have more goals and so forth, and within the framework of the bourgeois democracy, it's going to control the government. So that becomes a big threat to the development of industrial capitalism. And in fact, the whole direction of capitalism in the Western Hemisphere as to whether the United England would be the dominant power and would have been the one who wins the First World War and the Second World War, both of which is more. Or whether the United States industrial capitalists were going to be the world rulers was decided in this conflict, whereby either the South could smash down the North and become like a subordinate part of the British economy and a massive development industrialization there, or by the United States smashing the industrial North, smashing the South, it became dominant. So in related into this was the whole future of the ability to expand. You see, the ability of industrial capitalists in the North to be able to not only expand into the South and into the West, but to begin looking to the Caribbean, to be able to penetrate the Asian market and the European market. They couldn't do that so long as they had one large section of their economy pitted against them. And all the things they had to do, like tax to build an army and everything else, in order to expand their power. So the two came into deeper, deeper conflict. As one tended to want to make the United States support economically to England's industrial base, while the North was fighting to break out of this and to be able to build a counterpower to the British industrial base. So this brought about an irreconcilable struggle between the two as to whether the industrial producers would survive or not. And their survival became predicated on the smashing of the democracy. And the two came into a profound conflict to settle it. Now, as far as the labor supply question. Now, in the North, industrial capitalism develops for various reasons. One of them was, of course, that they were able to meet the labor problem. They just had large influx. But the agricultural staff, and this just opened the doors for migration out of the crisis that Europe was going in, a surplus of unemployment. And they came to the United States and were able to find jobs. So it was a continuous, by the way, getting myself into problems without being able to over the whole period. See, at first, the northern industrial capitalists are opposed to opening the lanes in order precisely to solve their labor problem. And they begin only to change that when they begin to get enough people. And they open the doors in the 1850s, the pouring into the United States with something, one of those figures is absolutely phenomenal, the number of people who came to the United States and build up this labor force. But in southern agriculture, you see, once the slave system was set up, you couldn't just easily make a transformation out and start introducing free once they had established the slaveocracy, they had to keep it out. It was just impossible. Now, see, there's been many plantations tried to introduce it, and there were cases where plantations ran it for several years and free labor. But in every one of the cases, they found it complicating the whole system, which was based on slavery. And all the capital that was invested, see, the logic of it was impossible to break at that point. Because after cotton kingdom ended, the plantations continued to be profitable, not very profitable, but they continued to be profitable. It was based upon wage labor. The Negro was not really a worker in the classical sense. That is, he was not free to quit his job, for instance. He was not free to move. He was a wage worker with all types of free happiness chains on him. In fact, I wish I could go into that more late to show what they had to do to stop him from moving. You know, during the First World War, Northerners came out and recruited laborers from the Negroes in the South. They were actually beat up and attacked by the local capitalists. So there were any Negroes to leave in the South. During the Second World War, when the migration became manual, and one of his little secret correspondences, the big liberal who's now in charge of the ACLU News, the National Sherman Bill, Sam Charles the Bill, that big liberal wrote in the secret correspondence that he was even considering proposing some way to stop the Negroes being able to leave the South because of certain requests he had. But as it turned out, the overall majority of the ruling class in the United States wanted the Negroes to come north, so they had more jobs, and therefore they didn't put any stop to the pen. But the problem remained in the South, as far as the labor. But it wasn't the type of problem that where the free labor could have been introduced. Once it had had, it would have completely shaken up the whole plantation structure. And that's the essence of the defeat of Reconstruction, was the need for that supply of cheap labor in the South. You can't just move people around, you know. That, I don't know if that's a full answer. I really don't know well enough American history in terms of knowing too much about exactly how the industrial capitalism rose in the period prior to the war in the North. So I really can't answer it well. You get a chance to